to retrieve my father's medical records from a server on the net. If the doctor called for x-rays, they'd be stored in digital form on a server, available for immediate review by any authorized doctor or specialist throughout the hospital or the world. Most of these kinds of applications are already starting to appear on PCs linked to the internet. Features get better all the time, and bandwidth will only increase, so interactive information sharing will become a part of everyday life.
The key issue that will hold back the popularity of the internet will be the issue of bandwidth. How much does it cost people to get a high-speed connection out to the internet? Because the internet experience is far richer when you move up to get the higher speeds. We're going to see quite a spread here. Businesses and universities will be able to connect at very high speeds because they have a density of users and they have an internal network that's easy to tie into the internet. The toughest part of the problem is people in their homes. For a long time, it's going to be primarily using the normal phone line with a 28.8 modem for most of those users. Now, there is great technology coming along to improve this, using the cable system of the PC cable modem. If you look 10 years down the road, a very high percentage of homes should have much higher speed connections.
The information highway doesn't exist. That may come as a surprise to people who've heard everything from a long-distance telephone network to the internet described as a data superhighway. Although the internet is already delivering communication services and information to millions of people, a broadband interactive network able to deliver the kind of killer applications I described earlier won't be available to the majority of U.S. homes for at least a decade. We simply won't have the high-speed infrastructure in place before then. The internet is the precursor of the ultimate global network. There is little doubt that when the global interactive network has finally evolved into the highway, it will still be called the internet. But as quaint as the term information highway is beginning to sound, using it appropriately helps to draw a distinction between today's primarily narrowband interactive network, the current internet, and tomorrow's broadband interactive network, or highway. Whatever it ends up being called, constructing an interactive network of enormous capacity, or bandwidth, is a big job. It calls for a dramatic evolution of the internet software and hardware platforms. Today, nearly all consumers who plug into online services or the internet use the telephone network's conventional twisted pair copper wires, a narrowband system that relies on analog tones to communicate information. In the early days of the IBM PC, a modem typically carried data at the rate of 300 to 1200 bits per second, also known as 300 or 1200 baud. Now, typical modems send and receive 28,800, or 28.8K, bits per second. This is a less agonizingly slow rate, but it's still not fast enough to gracefully accommodate many rich forms of content. There are modems capable of transmitting data at 33,600 baud, or even 38,400 baud, but modems won't be able to get much faster than this using normal phone lines. This is one reason the world is moving away from narrowband analog networks, which were designed to carry voice, and toward digital networks that carry much greater amounts of information per second. In the years ahead, telephone and cable companies will upgrade their networks with new digital switches and with fiber optic cable, which has far greater bandwidth than copper wire. Once the new infrastructure is in place, the era of broadband communications, or the era of the information highway, will have arrived. Except in business districts and other areas where there is a high density of people willing to pay for the connections, broadband networks won't be widespread for a number of years. However, the dramatic success of the internet beginning in 1995 demonstrated that millions of people would use narrowband interactive networks enthusiastically for PC tasks. At Microsoft, we believe that a wide range of applications would have to be available from the very beginning if the network were to succeed, and we set out both to create a software platform that would support myriad applications and to create innovative new applications ourselves. When we met to discuss our highway efforts in 1993 and 1994, I'd ask, "What are we doing on medical? What are we doing on travel? What are we doing on education? Do these applications build excitement? How are we going to get all the stuff we need developed?" We knew that we would have to get lots of other companies building these applications too. However, without the network, it was difficult to get other companies to invest. The industry just wasn't sure that a public who were assumed to want video first and foremost would settle for network connections that provided substandard video. The interactive revolution seemed to be stalled. Then, almost overnight, the internet answered the questions that hung over the industry. It became clear that the interactive network would be built first around the personal computer and later around the TV, which would itself become more like a PC. The industry realized that people would pay something for connectivity. It became apparent that early interactive content would not center on video-rich entertainment as much as on information and commerce applications, the kinds of content that work on narrowband networks but work even better on midband. Suddenly, midband connections had a huge future, and broadband service aimed at delivering video entertainment was off somewhere on the horizon. Today, the Internet's most popular application is web browsing. The World Wide Web is a network of servers connected to the Internet that offers pages of information containing text, graphics, sounds, and programming. The software to set up a website is very cheap. Software to browse the web is available for free for virtually all machines. PC operating systems are starting to integrate web browsing, and many PC applications now enable users to both read and write web pages. Compared to the broadband interactive network we'll see in a few years, the Internet has been slow, primitive, and difficult to use. But it's improving even faster than the PC did, and it promises to be as important. Already, the Internet's surging popularity is the most important single development in the world of computing since the IBM PC was introduced in 1981. Despite the PC's shortcomings, its popularity grew to the point that it became the standard hardware for which applications were developed. Companies that tried to fight the PC standard often had good reasons, but their efforts failed because so many other companies were invested in continuing to improve the PC. The lessons of the PC industry are not lost on companies such as Microsoft and Netscape, who are working together and in competition to define standards that will help overcome the Internet's limitations. Netscape and Microsoft are two of the companies supplying components of the software platform for interactive networks. We're all racing to embrace existing standards and extend them. It is clear that there will be only one primary software platform. This platform will be the standard not only in the public networks around the world, but in corporate networks too, the intranets that serve employees but restrict the access of anyone outside the corporate network's electronic firewall. The platform must evolve to the point that it offers first-rate navigation and security, group collaboration capabilities, billing and accounting services, and connections to arbitrary software components. The platform must define standards for expressing user preferences and passing them between applications seamlessly. It costs remarkably little to use the Internet. For what is often a flat monthly rate, the Internet provides U.S. customers with worldwide connections between servers, facilitating the exchange of electronic mail, bulletin board items, and other data. It costs no more for a user to request data from a server thousands of miles away than it does to ask for data from a server a mere mile away. As the Internet is changing the way we pay for communication, it may also change how we pay for information, or don't pay for it. Most of the investment in web-based publishing so far has been a labor of love, or an effort to help promote products sold in the non-electronic world. Some prognosticators think that the Internet has shown that information will be free, or largely so, and while it is true that a great deal of information, from NASA photos to bulletin board entries donated by users, will continue to be free, I believe that much of the most attractive information, whether Hollywood movies or encyclopedic databases, will be produced with profit in mind. It's hard to imagine the Internet thriving as a publishing medium unless content providers are paid for their work. There will be a lot of disappointment in the short run among content companies struggling to make ends meet through subscriptions or advertising, though. Advertisers usually hesitate to move into a new medium, and the Internet is certainly that. Some content companies are experimenting with a combination of subscriptions and advertising, but far fewer people will pay for content than will use it for free, so the subscriber base a content company can offer advertisers is reduced, which lowers ad rates and thus the content provider's ad revenue. An important technology that will work on a narrowband network is the sharing of a screen or a window on a screen so that it can be viewed by two or more people at different locations. Preliminary versions of this kind of capability are being built into web browsers already. If you call a friend to ask how to get to her house and you both have PCs connected to your phone lines, then during the conversation, she'll be able to transmit a map to you, which the two of you can discuss or even annotate interactively. A mid-band connection gives you about a factor of 8 improvement on average compared to the narrow bandwidth of a conventional modem. Pictures come onto a screen very fast when you have a mid-band connection, and you can even start to use low-quality video, especially if it's in a small window on your PC screen. The additional bandwidth makes quite a difference in the experience of using the web. Telephone companies are already delivering mid-band connections into homes by feeding them digital rather than analog signals. Conventional wiring is used, but the switches that route information differ from those used in what the industry calls POTS, or plain old telephone service. Telephone companies aren't the only players with the motivation and technology to put customers on the Internet at higher speeds. Cable companies intend to use their existing coaxial cable networks to connect PCs to the Internet, as well as compete with the phone companies to provide local telephone service. Besides finding ways to offer Internet and conventional telephone service, another interim step cable companies will take is to increase the number of broadcast channels they carry 5 to 10-fold. They'll get the bandwidth they need for this increase by expanding their use of fiber and by using digital compression technology. Having 300 or 500 new channels makes near video on demand possible, although for only a limited number of television shows and movies. It's unclear how many years it will take for millions of people to have broadband connections to the Internet. Fiber optic lines and other enabling technologies will gradually reach neighborhoods as telephone companies and cable television companies routinely upgrade their systems. But having some or even all of the infrastructure in place is not the same thing as having an interactive broadband network. Applications and content are needed too. Fortunately, the hardware and software pieces of the broadband network don't have to come together all at once. The public's embrace of the Internet gives us an evolutionary path. The evolution is being driven already by the public's growing appetite for bandwidth, and this demand is encouraging telephone and cable companies to invest in mid-band access to the Internet for their residential customers. Broadband connections will follow. The technology, applications, and content will be much more an outgrowth of the PC and the Internet, and much less an outgrowth of the TV than many people expected them to be just a few years ago. This evolutionary path makes sense, and it's going to happen.
Documents on the Internet, the pages that are up there, are showing rapid improvement in terms of taking advantage of what's possible. When people started out, they were mostly taking the idea of a paper document and simply transferring it to the screen. Now we're finding more and more of these documents not only are putting in pictures and sound, but they're putting in interactivity. The opportunity here is for creating a whole new document type, and the great work is really going on right now.
For more than 500 years, the bulk of human knowledge and information has been stored as paper documents. Paper will be with us for the foreseeable future, but its importance as a medium for finding, preserving, and distributing information is already diminishing. Soon we'll be able to do things with rich electronic documents we could never do with pieces of paper. The future network's powerful database technology will allow documents to be indexed and retrieved by means of interactive exploration. It will be extremely cheap and easy to distribute them. But let's not sell paper documents short. The paper-based book, magazine, or newspaper still has a lot of advantages over its digital counterpart. A newspaper offers a wide field of vision, good resolution, portability, ease of use. A book is small, lightweight, high resolution, and inexpensive compared to the cost of a computer or some other information appliance you need to read a digital document. For at least a decade, it won't be as convenient to read a long, sequential document on a computer screen as on paper. Ultimately, though, incremental improvements in computer and screen technology will give us a lightweight, universal electronic book, or e-book. Inside a case, roughly the same size and weight as today's hardcover or paperback book, you'll have a display for high-resolution text, pictures, and video. But the real point of electronic documents is not simply that we'll read them on hardware devices. The significant aspect of digital documents is the redefinition of the document itself, which will cause dramatic repercussions. We'll have to rethink not only what we mean by the term document, but also what we mean by author, publisher, office, classroom, and textbook. By the end of the decade, a significant percentage of documents, even in offices, won't be fully printable on paper. The document will be more like a movie or a song is today. You'll still be able to print out a two-dimensional view of its content, but that will be like reading a music score instead of listening to a recording. As you'd expect, digital documents can also be faster to work with than paper documents. You can transmit information instantly and retrieve information almost as quickly. People using digital documents now are already discovering how much simpler and quicker it is to search and navigate through them and how easy it is to restructure their content. When I was young, I loved my family's 1960 World Book Encyclopedia. Its heavy bound volumes contained just text and pictures. They showed me what Edison's phonograph looked like, but couldn't let me listen to its scratchy sound. The encyclopedia had photographs of a fuzzy caterpillar changing into a butterfly, but there was no video to bring that transformation to life. It would have been nice, too, if the encyclopedia could have quizzed me on what I'd read, or if the information had always been up to date. I wasn't aware of those deficiencies then, though. One of today's multimedia encyclopedias that comes on a single 1-ounce CD-ROM includes 26,000 topics, 9 million words of text, 8 hours of audio, more than 8,000 photographs and illustrations, more than 950 maps, 250 interactive charts and tables, and 100 animations and video clips. It contains 300,000 links that relate articles, and it costs less than $60 in the U.S. As the Internet and online reference works evolve, there will be no practical limit to the amount of detail you'll be able to explore on a subject that interests you. You'll be able to specify how long you want your daily newscast to last. You'll be able to have each news story selected individually for you. The newscast assembled for just you might include world news from NBC, the BBC, CNN, or the Los Angeles Times, with a weather report from your favorite local TV meteorologist. If during the newscast you want more information than has been put together for you, you'll be able to ask for more background or detail. Among the types of paper documents, narrative fiction is one of the few that's not clearly improved by electronic organization. It is linear. Likewise, we'll continue to watch most movies from start to finish. This isn't a technological judgment, it's an aesthetic one. Linearity is intrinsic to the conventional storytelling process. The network will make it easy to distribute digital documents cheaply, whatever their structure. Millions of people and companies will be creating documents and publishing them on the web. Some documents will be aimed at paying audiences, and some will be free to anybody who wants to pay attention. In any case, the cost of distribution will be very low. When you buy a paper book, a good part of your money goes for the cost of producing and distributing it. By the time the consumer decides to buy the book and the cash register rings, the profit for the author can be a pretty small piece of the pie compared to the money that goes to the people who manage the physical aspects of delivering information on processed wood pulp to the publisher, the printer, the distributor, and the bookseller. This is the friction of distribution, a drag on variety and a diversion of money away from the author and to other people. Publishing via a network is largely friction-free, a theme I'll explore a bit later. The Internet is a publishing medium with entry barriers lower than any we've ever seen, the greatest self-publishing vehicle ever. Its proliferation of bulletin boards, newsgroups, and web pages demonstrates the changes that take place when millions of people have access to low-friction distribution and anybody can post messages, images, or software. Mail or telephone communications are fine for a one-on-one discussion, but they get pretty expensive if you're trying to communicate with a group. It costs nearly $1 to print and mail just one letter, and on average, about that much for a long-distance call. And to make a conference call, you have to spend even more, assemble all the phone numbers, and have coordinated a time when everybody will be free to talk with the other people. It takes considerable time and effort to put even a modest-sized group of people in touch with each other. On a bulletin board, all you have to do is type your message in once, and it's available to everybody you want to reach. Bulletin boards on the Internet cover a wide range of topics. Along with email, they have been used to mobilize people who share a serious common concern or interest, too. During political conflicts in Russia, both sides were able to contact people throughout the world via postings on electronic bulletin boards. The Internet lets you contact people you have never met who share an interest with you. Perhaps the most powerful form of posting, the one that most resembles a traditional publication, is the web page. The quality of web publishing is uneven, as you'd expect in a medium in which anybody can publish and nobody can easily charge anything for their work. But, as millions of people have discovered, browsing the web can be enthralling even so. There's so much content that companies have sprung up to publish web pages that are nothing more than roadmaps to other web pages. The interactive network has enormous potential, but significant investments will be required to develop great online content that will attract PC users and raise the number online from 10% to 50% to the 90% I foresee. Content development has been held back somewhat because the simple, secure mechanisms authors and publishers need for charging users or advertisers are just beginning to appear. Over the next several years, the evolution of online service mechanisms will solve these problems and create an incentive for providers to furnish exciting, made-for-the-medium content. New billing options, monthly subscriptions, hourly rates, charges per item accessed, and advertising payments will get more revenue flowing to the information providers. Whenever a new medium comes on the scene, its early content is brought over from other media. Now, most online content from commercial print publishers includes lots of graphics, photos, and links to related information. As communications get faster and commercial opportunities become even more apparent, more audio and video elements will be brought into online content. CD-ROMs provide us with some models for the creation of online content. CD-ROM-based multimedia titles have integrated different types of information. Text, graphics, photographic images, animation, music, and video into single documents. And right now, there are best approximations of what the rich documents of the future will be like. Other than web pages, very few multimedia documents are being created by PC users so far. It still takes too much effort. But in the future, even kids in school will be able to produce their own photo albums or movies and use the net to make them available to friends and family. businesses of all types and sizes will communicate using multimedia. As the fidelity of visual and audio elements improves, we'll be able to more closely simulate many aspects of reality. This virtual reality, or VR, will enable us to go places and do things we never would be able to do otherwise. Vehicle simulators for airplanes, race cars, and spacecraft already give us a taste of virtual reality. A couple of friends and I tried a 747 simulator a few years ago. You sit down to a control panel in a cockpit identical to one in a real plane. Outside the windows, you see computer-generated color video images. You hear the rush of air around wings that aren't there, the clunk of non-existent landing gear retracting. Six hydraulic systems under the simulator tilt and shake the cockpit. It's pretty convincing. When I was using the simulator, my friends decided to give me a surprise by having a small plane fly by. While I sat in the pilot seat, the all-too-real-looking image of a Cessna flashed into view. I wasn't prepared for the emergency, and I crashed into the Cessna. A number of companies are putting smaller-scale simulator rides into shopping malls and urban sites. It won't be too many years before you'll be able to have a high-quality simulation in your living room. Imagination will be a key element in creating content for all new applications. The exponential expansion of computing power will keep changing the tools and opening up new possibilities. The Internet will offer undreamed-of artistic and scientific opportunities to a new generation of geniuses, and to everybody else, too.
Anyone who uses the Internet is likely to start to use it to gather information about purchasing decisions they want to make. Now, even today, if you're going to go and buy a car, I really recommend going up, looking at the used car prices, going to the manufacturer sites, or other third-party sites that have review-type information and really help you in that kind of purchase. Now, that's not to say that you'll actually buy the car on the Internet. The Internet will be used more broadly as a source of information than it will be for closing transactions in the next several years. The number of transactions on the Internet will rise dramatically as people understand that using a credit card there is absolutely as safe as using it for mail order or the many other ways that they use their credit card to buy things.
Over the next decade, businesses worldwide will be transformed. Intranets will revolutionize the way companies share information internally, and the internet will revolutionize how they communicate externally. Corporations will redesign their nervous systems to rely on the networks that reach every member of the organization and beyond into the world of suppliers, consultants, and customers. These changes will let companies be more effective and often smaller. In the longer run, as broadband networks make physical proximity to urban services less essential, many businesses will decentralize and disperse their activities, and cities may be downsized too. But in the near future, the development that will help businesses the most will be the widespread creation and use of intranets, or private internets used to share information inside organizations. Intranets build directly on the investments in information technology that companies have already made. Beginning in the 1980s, companies made huge expenditures for personal computers and the networks that connect them. Without question, these investments have extended the capabilities of individuals and have made for better information sharing inside companies. Businesses of all sizes benefit from personal computers, but small companies are arguably the greatest beneficiaries. Low-cost hardware and software allow even a tiny outfit to compete effectively in its area of focus with large multinational corporations. Someone running a small operation with a PC and a few software packages has electronic support for all the different functions she needs to perform. Even the smallest of all businesses, the individual earning a living in a profession or as an artist, has been empowered by the PC. One person, without any staff, can produce reports, handle correspondence, bill customers, and maintain a credible business presence, all surprisingly easily. The biggest benefit from personal computers in large companies is an improvement in the sharing of information. Conventionally, businesses share information internally by exchanging paperwork, making telephone calls, and gathering around conference tables and whiteboards. You need plenty of time and plenty of expensive face-to-face meetings and presentations to reach good decisions that way. The potential for inefficiency is enormous. Companies that continue to rely on these methods exclusively risk losing out to competitors who reach decisions faster while devoting fewer resources and probably fewer layers of management to the process. I liken setting up an intranet to fitting the final piece into a jigsaw puzzle. Businesses around the world are finding themselves in this happy position now. They've worked hard for years, investing in hardware, software, and training so that they can share information more easily. It's been a sound investment, but not quite all of the pieces have fallen into place yet. Creating documents has been made easy, but finding them has remained hard. Setting up an intranet will complete the picture, and it will cost many companies almost nothing to do because they've already bought all of the expensive pieces. Intranets are catching on like wildfire in the corporate world, and with good reason. Just as email is replacing many written memos, phone calls, and meetings, the intranet web page is replacing reports, manuals, forms, filing cabinets, phone directories, cork bulletin boards, and newsletters. Internal websites have become repositories of corporate procedures and sources of the latest information on project status, revenues, and decisions of all kinds. Increased use of email, both inside and outside a company, will be supplemented by internal and external uses of video conferencing. Meetings will be conducted electronically. Part of the screen might show a participant's face, while another part displays a document. If anybody modifies the document, the change will appear almost immediately on all of the screens. Collaborators at different sites will be able to work together in rich ways. Some people worry that by eliminating the subtle human dynamics that go on in a meeting, video conferences and shared screens will give corporate gatherings all the spontaneity of a congressional photo opportunity. How will people whisper, roll their eyes at a tedious speaker, or pass notes? Clandestine communication will be simpler at a video meeting because the software can allow side communications. Meetings have always had unwritten rules, but when the network is mediating video conferences, some rules will have to become explicit. Will people be able to signal, publicly or privately, individually or collectively, that they are bored? To what degree should a participant be allowed to block his or her video or audio from the others? Can multiple people speak at the same time? Should private side conversations, one PC to another, be permitted? Over time, as we use video conferencing facilities, new rules of meeting etiquette will emerge, just as they did with the telephone and email. As computers become more powerful, it will be possible for a standard PC to fabricate realistic synthetic images. Your phone or computer will be available to generate a lifelike digital image of your face, showing you listening or even talking. You really will be talking, it's just that you will have taken the call at home while you were dripping wet from the shower. As you talk, your phone will synthesize an image of you in your most businesslike suit. Your facial expressions will match your words. Remember, small computers are going to get very powerful. During the years before the broadband infrastructure has been delivered to many homes, businesses will still be able to reach into homes in practical and effective ways. High-quality video won't be involved, but screen images and simultaneous conversation will be shared across mid-band connections, and even across narrow-band connections. Here's one way it'll work. Let's say you're an attorney, and one of your clients decides to change his will. The client calls, and you say, "Let's take a quick look at that." You call the will up on your PC, and it appears on your client's screen, too. The two of you discuss his needs, and he watches on his screen as you edit the will on your screen. Software operating across the internet or on an intranet will also make it easier to schedule meetings. If your client wants to sit down face-to-face with you to discuss his will, his scheduling program and yours will be able to communicate and pick a date and time you both have free. Then the appointment will just show up on your respective electronic calendars. Clients will expect their lawyers, dentists, accountants, and other professionals to be able to schedule appointments and exchange documents electronically. We'll see competition based on how effectively one professional group has adopted these communications tools and how much more accessible and efficient this makes them. All of these electronic innovations are ways of overcoming physical separation. As they become commonplace, they'll change not just the way we work together, but also the distinction we make between the workplace and everywhere else. By 1996, in the United States, there were already more than 8 million telecommuters who didn't travel to the office every day, but instead commuted via fax machines, telephones, and email. Ever larger numbers of writers, engineers, attorneys, and other people who do their jobs relatively autonomously stay at home for at least part of their work hours. Employees who do most of their work on the telephone are strong candidates for telecommuting because calls can be routed to them. Telemarketers, customer service representatives, reservation agents, and product support specialists will have access to as much information on a screen at home as they would on a screen at an office. New feedback mechanisms will have to evolve so that both the employer and the employee can determine the quality of the work being done. Information technology will affect much more than the physical location and supervision of employees. The very nature of almost every business organization will have to be re-examined. This re-examination should include a critical look at the organization's structure and at the balance between its inside full-time staff and the outside consultants and firms it works with. The next movement will be to redefine the boundary between a company and its customers and suppliers. Key questions to re-examine include, how will customers find out about our products? How will customers order? What new competitors will emerge as geography becomes less of a barrier? How can our company do the best job of keeping customers happy after the sale? New corporate structures will evolve. As technology makes it easier for a business to find and collaborate with outside expertise, a huge and competitive market for consultants will arise. If you're looking for work as an employee or a contractor, the system will match you with potential employers and be able to send your resume out electronically with the click of a button. Lots of companies will eventually be far smaller because using the internet will make it easy to find and work with outside resources. Geographic dispersion will affect much more than corporate structure. Many of today's major social problems have arisen because the population has been crowded into urban areas. If the population of a city were reduced by even 10%, the result would be a major difference in property values and in wear and tear on transportation and other urban systems. If the average office worker in any major city stayed home 1 or 2 days a week, the decreases in gas consumption, air pollution, and traffic congestion would be significant. The net effect on city finances is hard to predict. If the people who moved out of cities were mostly the affluent knowledge workers, the urban tax base would be reduced. This would aggravate the inner city's woes and encourage other affluent people to leave. But at the same time, the urban infrastructure might be less heavily loaded. Rents would fall, reducing the cost of living for people who remained in the cities. It will take decades before the full impact of rich electronic communication is understood. My advice is to get to know these empowering new technologies. The more you know about them, the more helpful they will be.
When we look at content out on the web, there's several different categories. There's content that people just enjoy creating for free, using their spare time because something's a hobby, because they're just contributing to a bulletin board, and that will always be there and be there in large numbers. Then we have content that's created to help another business. It's sort of a marketing cost. Third category is content that is simply created for the web. It's a magazine only on the web. It's a fun site that's out there on the web. And for people doing that, if they have a for-profit business, they have to consider, how are they going to make money? And this is one of the great unanswered questions about the web. Although advertising is growing explosively, there really isn't going to be enough to go around to fund even a small percentage of the sites being created. And so people are wondering, will they be able to charge subscription fees? I think there will be a lot of successes there, but the growth of advertising and the balance of subscription revenue, that's something that a lot of business plans are dependent on, and it'll be fascinating to see how that plays out.
When Adam Smith described the concept of markets in Wealth of Nations in 1776, he theorized that if every buyer knew every seller's price and every seller knew what every buyer was willing to pay, everyone in the market would be able to make fully informed decisions and society's resources would be distributed efficiently. To date, we haven't achieved Smith's ideal because would-be buyers and would-be sellers hardly ever have complete information. If you're trying to find a doctor, a lawyer, an accountant, or a similar professional, or you're shopping for a house, your information is incomplete, and it's hard to make comparisons. The Internet will extend the electronic marketplace and become the ultimate go-between, the universal middleman. Often, the only humans involved in a transaction will be the actual buyer and seller. All the goods for sale in the world will be available for you to examine, compare, and often customize. When you want to buy something, you'll be able to tell your computer to find it for you at the best price offered by any acceptable source, or to ask your computer to haggle with the computers of various sellers. Servers distributed worldwide will accept bids, resolve offers into completed transactions, control authentication and security, and handle all the other functions of a marketplace, including the transfer of funds. We'll find ourselves in a new world of low-friction, low-overhead capitalism, in which market information will be plentiful and transaction costs low. It will be a shopper's heaven. As the interactive network assumes the role of market maker in category after category of goods and services, traditional middlemen will have to contribute real value to a transaction to justify their commissions. But the middlemen who provide added value will not only survive, they will thrive, because the information highway will let them make their services available to customers everywhere. These ideas will alarm some retailers and consumers. Change can feel threatening. But as with so many changes, I think once we get used to them, we'll wonder how we got along before them. The consumer will get not only competitive cost savings, but also a much wider variety of products and services to choose from. Online catalogs are beginning to appear, and people who take the time to browse discover good buys as well as unusual shopping opportunities. A colleague of mine who wanted the first edition of The Road Ahead in Italian was able to order it by finding the web page of a bookstore in Italy and inquiring via email. A helpful store employee responded in English and happily took his credit card number. On the network, lots of product information will be available directly from manufacturers. As they do today, vendors will use a variety of entertaining and provocative techniques to attract us. Advertising will evolve into a hybrid, a combination of today's television commercials and infomercials, magazine ads, and detailed sales brochures. And you'll get more than product feature information. The online world empowers you to bring pricing anomalies into clear view. Great news if you're a consumer, but probably not if you're a high-priced producer or high-markup retailer. The depth of detail and the number of sources of information on the network will increase dramatically. You won't have to depend on what a manufacturer tells you about a product. You'll be able to read independent reviews and information. After you've seen a product's reviews, advertising, and multimedia manuals, you might ask if data on the product from government regulatory agencies is available. There will also be places online where professional information and advice will be offered for a fee. You might need an expert to help you sort out all the information that will be available for the same reason you might need an expert now. On the network, you'll be able to hire a knowledgeable sales consultant for 5 minutes or an afternoon. Via video conference, she'll help you choose products which your computer will then buy for you from the cheapest reliable source. The cost of the independent consultation will be offset by the quality of the advice you receive and by the time you save and the lower price you might end up paying at an outlet the consultant guides you to. On a broadband network, you'll be able to browse globally and at your own pace among goods and services. If you're looking for a sweater, you'll choose a basic style and see as many variations as you like in every price range. Because broadband networks will carry high-quality video, you'll often be able to see exactly what you've ordered. This will help prevent the sort of mistake my grandmother once made. I was at summer camp, and she ordered some lemon drops to be sent to me. She ordered 100, thinking I would get 100 pieces of candy. Instead, I got 100 bags. I gave them out to everybody and was especially popular until we all developed canker sores. Once you know exactly what you want, you'll be able to get it just the way you want it. Computers will enable the kinds of goods that are mass-produced today to become custom-made for particular customers. Customization will become an important way for a manufacturer to add value. Increasing numbers of products, from shoes to chairs, from newspapers and magazines to music albums, will be created on the spot to match the exact specifications of a particular person. Often the customized item will cost no more than a mass-produced one would. In many product categories, mass customization will replace mass production, just as a few generations ago, mass production largely replaced made-to-order. Soon, for example, computerized shirt-making machines will obey a different set of instructions for every shirt. When you order, you'll indicate your measurements as well as your choices for fabric, fit, collar, and every other variable. The information will be communicated to a manufacturing plant that will produce the shirt for prompt delivery. Levi Strauss & Company is already experimenting with custom-made jeans for women. At a growing number of their outlets, customers pay about $10 extra to have jeans made to their exact specifications. Any of 8,448 different combinations of hip, waist, inseam, and rise measurements and styles. The information is relayed from a PC in the store to a Levi's factory in Tennessee, where the denim is cut by computer-driven machines, tagged with barcodes, and then washed and sewn. The finished jeans are sent back to the store where the order was placed or shipped overnight directly to the customer. A great deal of investment and innovation in the delivery of news lies ahead. Many sports fans are already hooked on ESPNet Sports Zone, a sports news site developed by Starwave and ESPN, the cable sports network 80% owned by Disney. Microsoft and NBC have formed MSNBC, which is both a cable news channel and a presentation of news on the web. Many newspapers now have websites, although so far, most of them are simply putting their content intended for print into electronic form, rather than taking much advantage of the new opportunities for interactivity, updating, accountability, and efficiency. All of the potential for electronic efficiency makes some people worry that if they use interactive networks to shop or get their news, they'll miss out on the serendipity of running into a surprisingly interesting article in the newspaper or finding an unexpected treat at the mall. But these surprises are hardly random. Newspaper editors know a lot about their readers' interests from experience. Once in a while, the New York Times publishes a front-page article about an advance in mathematics. The somewhat specialized information is presented with an angle that makes it interesting to a good number of readers. In the same way, buyers for stores think about what's new and might intrigue their type of customer. There will be plenty of opportunities for calculated surprise on interactive networks. From time to time, your software agent will try to persuade you to fill out a questionnaire about your tastes. The information you furnish will go into a profile of your tastes, which will guide the agent. It will keep track of what you've indicated an interest in, as well as what you've happened upon and then pursued. The agent will use this information as it prepares various surprises to attract and hold your attention. Whenever you want something offbeat and appealing, it will be waiting for you. Needless to say, there will be lots of controversy and negotiation about who can get access to your profile information. It will be crucial, of course, that you have such access. To protect privacy, systems will be established that allow software agents to use profile information without learning anybody's individual identity. For example, an agent could notify me that David Halberstam, one of my favorite authors, had a new book out, but all that anyone would know is that a list of anonymous people had been notified. My identity, or yours, would be protected. Today, advertising subsidizes nearly all of the programs we watch on television and the articles we read in magazines. Advertisers place their messages in the programs and publications that attract the largest audience likely to want what they're selling. The net will be able to make much finer distinctions among consumers and to deliver to each consumer a different stream of advertising. This will benefit all parties, the consumers, because ads will be better tailored to their specific interests and therefore more interesting to them, and the producers and online publications, because they'll be able to sell advertisers focused blocks of viewers and readers. Data on preferences will be gathered and disseminated without violating anyone's privacy, because the interactive network will be able to use information about consumers to route advertising without revealing which specific households have been targeted. Because individually targeted ad streams will be flowing through the network all the time, video advertising is likely to become cost-effective even for small advertisers. A store's ads might target only a few city blocks and address very specific neighborhoods or communities of interest. Every city of any size in the U.S. already has several companies offering classified advertising on the Internet. The first of these services weren't particularly compelling because not many people used them. They were marketplaces without many buyers or sellers. But this state of affairs will change. At some point, word of mouth from satisfied customers will draw more and more users to the best of the network's classified ad services. When a critical mass is achieved, which might be only a year or two after a service is first offered, the classified ad site will be transformed from a curiosity into a primary way private sellers and buyers get together. All kinds of entertainment delivery and pricing schemes will be tried. A song could be made available on a pay-per-hearing basis. Remember jukeboxes? Each time you listen to it, your account would be charged some small amount, such as 5 cents. At that rate, it would cost 60 cents to listen to a 12-song album. You'd have to play the whole album 25 times to spend $15, which is roughly what a compact disc sells for today. If you found that you liked only one song on the album, you could play it 300 times at a nickel each time for your $15. We may see digital entertainment that has an expiration date or that allows only a certain number of plays before it has to be bought again. A record company might offer a song for a very low price but let you play it only 10 or 20 times. Or they might let you play a song or an addictive game 10 times free before asking whether you want to buy it. Copyright laws will need to be clarified to ensure that they work in an online environment. The network will force us to think more explicitly in every field and for every market about what rights users have to intellectual property. Everything I've described so far is a direct or indirect implication of an extremely efficient marketplace. Almost any person or business that serves as a middleman will feel the heat of electronic competition. A small-town lawyer will probably face new competition when legal services are available by video conference over the network. A person buying a piece of property might choose to consult with a sharp real estate attorney from the other side of the country rather than use a local lawyer who is a generalist. There's recompense, though. The resources of the network will enable the local lawyer to retrain and become an expert in any specialty of her choice. And from her small town, she'll be able to compete electronically in the specialty because of her lower overhead. Clients will benefit as well. The prices for executing routine legal tasks, such as the drafting of wills, will be driven down by the efficiency and specialization of the electronic marketplace. Banking is another industry destined for change. Banks will be particularly vulnerable to price wars, in which customers will shop for banking on the basis of costs and interest rates alone. A bank will have to find ways to maintain its identity and justify its role as a middleman by adding value. Customers will be able to let the banks know in no uncertain terms what they like and don't like, and the banks will be able to turn on a dime to innovate and to fine-tune their services. Consumers will be pleased to discover that a lot of the interest rate differential between large and small deposits will disappear. With the communications available on the network, middlemen will emerge to aggregate small customers efficiently and get them a rate very close to the one large depositors are offered. Some brokerage houses now offer low-cost stock trading across the Internet at a fraction of what it costs to work directly with a flesh-and-blood stockbroker. As the network gets more efficient, investment choices will proliferate. Stockbrokers, like other middlemen whose jobs have been merely to chaperone a transaction, will probably have to offer something more. They'll add value by being knowledgeable. Financial services companies will still thrive. Industry after industry will be changed, and change is unsettling. Some middlemen who handle information or product distribution will find that they no longer add value, and they'll change fields, whereas others will rise to the competitive challenge. The new efficiency in the marketplace will create all sorts of exciting employment opportunities. There will be dislocations, but overall, society will benefit from the changes. As the Internet evolves into a broadband, global, interactive network, product and service providers will see what buyers want a lot more efficiently than ever before, and consumers will buy more efficiently. I think Adam Smith would be pleased.
I really envy kids who are growing up today because of this accessibility to information in an engaging form. You've got the pictures, you've got the sounds, you've got the links that you can explore, and the ability to test your knowledge, to say, you know, what level of skill do you have understanding some branch of science or history or any topic that you want to explore. And so I think it's a fantastic time to be growing up, whether you're very, very young and it's just the simple game story type creations, or whether you're older and you have a subject that you really want to dive into and see what the experts are working on, find out what the state of the art is. All of that is going to be at people's fingertips, partly through the great CD-ROMs that are being done, but more and more through the online information that'll be out there and available. And so every student will have more opportunity than the most privileged student had just a decade ago.
Maybe it's just my innate optimism, but I expect education of all kinds to improve significantly within the next decade. I believe that information technology will empower people of all ages, both inside and outside the classroom, to learn more easily, enjoyably, and successfully than ever before. The basic purpose of the PC, managing information to support thinking, aligns superbly with the mission of educational institutions. Improving education is the best investment we can make because, downstream, benefits flow to every part of society. That's why putting computers and the Internet to work in schools is an exhilarating prospect. As you think about my arguments, keep my perspective in mind. I'm not an educator, but I am a learner. And one of the things I like best about my job is that I'm surrounded by other people who love to learn. In a technology business, everybody has to acquire knowledge at a prodigious rate. At Microsoft, we read, ask questions, explore, go to lectures, compare our notes and findings with each other, consult experts, daydream, brainstorm, formulate and test hypotheses, build models and simulations, communicate what we're learning, and practice new skills. These are the same activities that go on in the best classrooms, but with a critical difference. At Microsoft, these learning activities get a boost from the latest computing and communications technologies. Microsoft succeeds because its employees learn efficiently and in part by using information tools. I've always been concerned about education, but now that I'm a father, I find myself giving it even more thought. I've seen from personal experience how learning is enhanced when the right tools are at hand and how difficult it is when good tools and information aren't available. Human potential is wasted when students everywhere, especially children who just naturally love computers and interaction, don't have access to the information technology that's commonplace in forward-thinking businesses. The relatively small number of PCs in the schools come from a hodgepodge of sources. They're often incompatible with each other and not powerful enough to run up-to-date software. Quite a few of them don't have the storage capacity or the network connections that would enable them to adequately respond to a learner's curiosity. It's not just good late-model PCs that are in short supply in schools. Sufficient electrical outlets, conduit for network cables, phone lines for online access, secure locations for hardware, and budget for maintenance are missing too. Reed Hunt, chairman of the U.S. Federal Communications Commission, is among the people who have commented on this. There are thousands of buildings in this country with millions of people in them who have no telephones, no cable television, and no reasonable prospect of broadband services, he said. They are called schools. A lot of people are cynical about technology and education because it has been